On the Emperor podcast this week, we interview one of the biggest movie stars of the 1980s and the man who inspired one of my favorite Twitter gags of all time, Emilio Estevez. Same person for both descriptors there. Let's just hope he didn't take the lift on the way here. All that and the usual news and nonsense on the movie podcast that is excited for Valentine's Day. Because when you realize you want to spend the rest of your Friday morning recording a movie podcast, you want that Friday morning to start right away. That's from When Harry Met Sally.
Yes, I know.
Which is a romantic film.
Is it though?
Kind of is. They get together at the end, don't they? Spoiler
I meant
alert.
The other bit. Is it from Harry Met Sally?
I don't know.
I don't remember them talking about podcasts.
Ahead of its time.
They really were.
Ahead of its time.
So were. Yeah. What a great movie.
Hello, pod. I'm Chris Hewitt. Welcome to the Empire Podcast. This week, I'm joined by two colleagues of such lethal cunning. You have heard one already. It is when Potty met Helen.
Okay. Know, hello.
I'm riffing here. I don't know. I'm drowning. Throw me a rope. Helen O'Hara is here. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you.
Excellent, excellent. And we're also joined by James Dyer, whose favorite romantic comedy is, I'm guessing,
James Actually.
You are unbearable and insufferable and unfunny.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was thinking about this morning for reasons that I can't really say.
We should do a Love Actually spoiler special, by the way. Let's just pop that up.
We should do it.
Oh my God.
We should get Richard Curtis and put him on trial. No, I'm kidding. I love it.
You do love it.
I do love it, genuinely, without irony as well. But I was thinking, most romantic films was the thing that was going around my head this morning. And I was thinking, if I had to pick, I would pick Richard Linklater's Before trilogy for this.
Oh, that's pretty great.
Because I was just thinking about it. I don't know that anything else feels quite so, you know, real, but not in a kind of grueling, heart-rending, I want to kill myself kind of way. Like real, but with a positivity to it. Positivity, uh-huh. But with realism. Because obviously Before Midnight is actually quite a rocky road. Uh-huh. Not the ice cream, obviously.
Although that's delicious.
Although that is delicious. And I think the film would have been improved with it.
Yes.
But,
I prefer Hulka Hulka Burning Fudge myself.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think Brief Encounter is up there. Brief Encounter is fantastic.
That's a bit short for me.
Brief's Encounter being, of course, the porn parody.
I really hope not, but I'm sure you're right.
It's a prequel to Gaspar Noé's Love.
Oh, no. That is not a film I need to see again.
Don't watch that by mistake. Don't sit down with your relatives thinking that you're about to watch the Paul Rust.
Lovely.
Gillian Jacobs sitcom that's also on Netflix. Two things called Love on Netflix. And I was an hour into the Gaspar Noé film. Before.
Where are you? Because, I mean, well, it's frankly, very obvious in the opening shots.
Well, I'd kind of fallen asleep by then. If I'm falling asleep.
Oh.
What? I was tired.
Oh, God. Here we are. Anyway. How many minutes are we into the podcast and your first ejaculation joke? It's going to be a long morning.
Yeah. Usually it's a lot earlier than that. And sometimes unexpected. Oh, come on! Come on! Hey, good news. I got my nectar offers in for the week. Red chilies, vanilla custard, fresh packed rosemary, pea shoots, chicken breast fillets, baby leaf spinach, and baby plum tomatoes.
I'm genuinely unsure whether this is a bit or you're just reading off the notifications on your phone screen.
I'm reading off the notifications on my phone.
Okay, thank you. This is useful.
What happens when you don't write a script. The most romantic film of all time. It's obviously While You Were Sleeping.
Because he leans, he does lean. Although the best leaner is still, obviously, in my so-called life, that Jared Leto's peak.
yeah, it was all downhill from there.
It's genuinely been a series of disappointments ever since.
Come on, while you were sleeping. While you were sleeping.
I mean, anyway.
What's wrong with While You Were Sleeping?
It's very cute.
It's
I love it a lot.
It's a lovely film. It's Sandy Bullock, she likes me to call her, at her peak sandiness. And it's just really, really lovely.
It's creepy as all fuck. What is wrong with you?
How is it creepy?
Oh, I'm sorry.
It's not the person in the coma that she actually, you know, ends up with. Spoiler.
Yeah, but I'm sorry. There's so many problematic parts of that film.
I'm sorry. The person in the coma is Peter Gallagher.
You love Love Actually.
Yeah, what are you saying?
Which has
so many problematic bits in it.
It has.
I love it for its imperfections.
Rick Grimes turns up on his best friend's doorstep.
See, people fixate on that. I don't even think that's the wrongest part of it.
I mean, there's
the whole Alan Rickman thing is wildly problematic.
There's the bit where Hugh Grant gets a woman fired because he fancies her.
Yep.
That's not so right.
I mean, it's. I mean, if you're going to indict Love Actually, I would say Andrew Lincoln would be like the 15th witness you'd call.
There's like every woman in America is very easy.
And don't even get me on the fucking Chris Marshall storyline, which is the absolute worst.
But in fairness, we don't know this every woman in America. It's just the three he happens to meet in that small town.
Mm-hmm.
Why do I know Love Actually so well?
I don't know.
I don't know why we're talking about Love Actually in the most romantic
films. Is it Denise Richards, Shannon Elizabeth, and Alicia Cuthbert? Is that who he comes
January
back with?
January Jones is in there.
And January
well.
Jones! I've forgotten that.
Who turns up at the end?
That's what we're saying.
Denise Richards turns up at the end. She's real friendly. That's what they say. Or something like
and
that.
And I thought Christmas comes when
yeah, well, I knew someone was going to say that.
Yes, none of the Bond films are the most romantic ever made, so we can rule that out.
But what is the
right
most romantic
now.
Bond film, Helen? It's
He's attempting
be...
re-entry, Mom.
Bond, what are you doing? I'm afraid he's ejaculated prematurely, sir. It's got to be on a Majesty's Secret Service, hasn't it? Or is it Casino Royale where, you know, Vesper tends him back to
health? Oh, it's definitely
health.
One where a woman dies for no reason. Anyway, most romantic films ever made. I mean, Casablanca is obviously... Casablanca is obviously up there.
I see, I don't find that romantic. I find him quite rude. He's very gruff with a sharp tongue, and I just like the way he speaks to her, frankly, I think is bang out of order.
Okay, it's from a different time.
Still, see, that's the defense, isn't it? It was a different time. Oh, it's all okay. You disgust me.
Yep, Bogart's cancelled. Bond is cancelled.
Oh my God.
Sandra Bullock is cancelled.
Okay.
Yeah.
His Girl Friday. Because the entire thing is a scheme.
No, surely Cary Grant's cancelled.
His ex-wife back.
He's cancelled.
He must be cancelled.
He must be cancelled.
Cary Grant, let me tell you, is never cancelled. No one is cancelling Cary Grant. Not on my watch.
No, Cary Grant's gone. He is gone.
Nah.
First of all, he's changed his name. So what dark, shady shit is he trying to hide from his past in Bristol? Okay. Archibald Leach is your real name, pal. Own up to that. And then,
witness
of course,
protection.
All that stuff he does, you know, the way he tortures that poor fellow who looks just like Ralph Bellamy. what's up with that?
I mean, that's fair.
Cancel that motherfucker.
No,
that's what
never,
I say.
Ever, ever, ever.
So looking back on it, I don't know. The only unimpeachable rom-com I can think of is Annie Hall.
Are you fucking kidding me? I appreciate that Annie Hall is a great film, but here's what gets me about Annie Hall.
I don't like
it. I know, but here's what gets me about it. It's the rom-com that every fucking male says he loves, right? It's the one that all men...
No.
This is the one that every...
No. I've seen it once. I didn't like it very much.
Okay, you're an exception.
I am. I'll do all things.
Every cinema-loving male is like, oh, I don't like rom-coms, they're shit, blah, blah, blah. I like Annie Hall, though. And that's the exception they'll give themselves because, of course, the couple don't end up together and therefore it reinforces all their bullshit nihilism that they picked up in their teenage years. I can't be having with that. So I like Annie Hall as a film, but it's one of these cases where everyone who likes Annie Hall a lot puts me off the film.
10 Things I Hate About You. I defy anyone not to just go gooey when he does the serenade sequence at the football stadium.
I didn't like it very much.
Oh, are you?
You are
what is
dead
wrong
inside.
With you?
I maybe need to revisit it.
You do,
I didn't like
do.
It very much. All right, so what about... This isn't even the reader's question, by the way. This is
my question.
We started off with. No one can have a problem whatsoever either using the moral strictures of today or just for sheer entertainment value with Clueless, right?
Yeah, that's correct.
Nothing bad happens...
No.
Does manipulate people, doesn't she?
No, she doesn't. She just tries to set them up to try and make them happy. And then she learns the error of her ways and ends up with Paul Rudd. It's what we're all after. No, Clueless is unimpeachable. When Harry Met Sally, to be fair, is unimpeachable. Like, you can't argue with Harry Met
Sally. Even if you impeached him, nothing would happen.
No, exactly. Well, that's...
That's topical.
Hey.
Satire. Hashtag Bremner, hashtag Bird, hashtag Fortune.
Those are pretty much great. I'm trying to think. I mean, there are great rom-coms out there.
What's the most romantic film in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, Helen?
Ooh. Well, I guess there's a whole bit of romance in Iron Man 3. Like, in relationship romance, which
Trevor
is...
Trevor Slattery with
well.
Those ladies. Yeah, I wouldn't go in there for another 15 minutes.
I mean, that's considerate of him, isn't it?
It is. Yeah,
really,
he's
awful.
A loving guy.
No, I kind of meant Tony and Pepper there, actually.
Yes.
There's not a lot of sexy time in Marvel movies.
Well, no, this is actually something that's been commented
Nobody
on.
Fucks.
Look,
no, Steve Rogers.
You're just not asking
you're
the right fan
fiction. Steve, definitely. Yeah. And did you know what? He of all of them, he is probably...
No, I've long said he's a fucking virgin.
You think?
You've long said this.
I don't know. Didn't he got it on with Emily Van Camp?
No, he didn't, but...
Oh, you like to think he didn't, Helen, because it makes you jealous,
I think
it's implied.
No,
it was just, it's implied.
It was just a lovey kissy.
Really?
Yeah.
Was it though?
Well, yes.
Well, yeah, because he immediately went off on the run.
Yeah, and then he didn't see her again for ages.
That we know of.
Yeah.
Not clothed, anyway.
I think, no, but genuinely, I do think that there is more romance in the first Captain America than most Marvel films, simply because they didn't have the budget for anything else. So... romance is cheaper.
My bad.
So I think there's an argument to be made for the first Avenger.
The Spider-Men have more romance than most.
Yeah. Yeah, well, both really good female leads, I think.
Peter and MJ, I'm there for that particular relationship.
I mean, again, they're teenagers, so you shouldn't be there. You should not be watching.
Obviously, I'm not watching. I'm not literally physically there because there are laws.
Conventions.
Yes, conventions, that's right. This got awkward.
Custom dictates.
One should not be watching.
Yes, it's frowned upon. But only if you're discovered, I find.
No, Chris.
Anyway, okay, should we move on?
Sure.
Okay. Oh, God, we better.
Happy Valentine's Day.
Happy Valentine's Day, everybody.
It could all fuck off.
It could all fuck off. There you go. Joker, he has that lovely relationship, doesn't he, with Sazie Beetz's character.
Yeah, nothing wrong with
There's
that.
His name you remember, which is a really good sign for a relationship.
Sazie Beetz's character. Woman in apartment.
I forgot the right answer.
Which is?
In the Mood for Love. Wildly romantic. You know, it's that old story where your husband and your wife are having an affair and the two of you get together to kind of like sympathize with each other, and then there's more of a spark, if anything, there than there are between your two cheating spouses.
What's that film with Wesley Snipes and Ming-Na Wen where there's affairs and they end up swapping partners?
What?
No?
No.
I have to look this up now. This is going to drive me nuts. I have a vivid memory of this film.
Okay.
Hold, please.
I think I know what you're talking about.
There you go. Just to prove that I'm not making this up and going insane.
But right. My initial instinct, because you didn't finish your sentence, was, what's that film with Wesley Snipes? And I immediately went to Passenger 57. And I was like,
yes.
How romantic is Passenger 57?
It's not the most romantic of his films, but, you know.
Blade's pretty romantic.
Some motherfuckers are always...
That bit at the end where, the lady offers her neck to him and it's pretty hot.
One Night Stand.
Is that Mike Figgis' film?
It is indeed Mike Figgis' film, yes. Natasha Kinski, Carl McLachlan are the other ones in it.
Indeed.
Probably Downey Jr.'s in it as well. That's a hot fact for you.
Indeedly Beedly.
Wow. I have almost no memory of that film.
All right, so time to take a quick listener question. This comes from regular podcast listener question contributor and listener, in fact, Felicity Kate, who I believe hails from the newest of Zealands, all the way over there in Kiwi land. Hello, Felicity. How are you? Or Kate, could be. I don't know.
Sure.
Felicity, I think. She asks, simply, favourite non-Star Wars robot?
I think I mentioned this on the pod before, but my baby nephew is currently obsessed with WALL-E and runs around saying, calling him Deet Doot.
Just not his name, so he's clearly an idiot.
Well, that's the sound he makes, though, which is pretty good for like a two-year-old. He's got Eve. He can say Eve, but he can't say WALL-E, so it's Deet Doot. Anyway, Deet Doot is my answer as a result.
Deet Doot. Pixar's Deet Doot.
Mm.
Okay, why him though? Just because of the
nephew thing?
Oh,
he's adorable. I mean, yes, also, but he's adorable and funny and romantic. I mean, we're talking about most romantic films. Hello, Dolly would be his answer. And
he'd be wrong though, wouldn't he?
I mean,
he should see more films.
He's got some great tunes. I think it's magical.
Oh, that's nice.
That is actually a very romantic Pixar film.
Yeah, it is.
That would be my pick for most romantic Pixar film, apart from the first 50 minutes of Up, which is the most romantic thing that's ever happened, but, you know.
Well, the whole of Up is romantic, because he's doing it for his dead
wife. I know, but you kind of lose sight of that as the film goes along.
But then then you remember it at the end when he finds the ledger and the journal and whatnot.
Yeah, and the two chairs, like, left sitting on the...
Yeah.
On the thing.
Yeah,
and then the house basically represents them as well. And it's just lovely. It's such a good movie.
So, robots.
Robots. Are there any other robots in Pixar? Any other robots generally?
I mean, there's the film Robots. Marvin the Paranoid Android.
Nobody.
Of course.
Number Johnny 5.
Johnny Five is alive.
Johnny Five is problematic.
Fisher Stevens is problematic. I'm not sure it's Johnny Five is the problem in that film.
That's a good point.
Fisher Stevens, who, and I think we should say, Oscar winner Fisher Stevens.
The Oscar winning Fisher Stevens. It's a different time in Hollywood then, wasn't it? Where it's not just that they got a white guy to play an Indian character, but they doubled down on it by making him the lead of the sequel, which continues to blow my mind.
It's pretty something. What about the threesome in Silent Running? They're cute.
I don't remember
the threesome scene in Silent Running.
The three robots.
Wow, what director's cut did you watch?
Oh boy. I mean, that would have been really like logistically difficult because of reasons. Anyway.
Oh my word. They're mm-hmm. good.
Replicants count? Do we count, you know?
Do they dream of electric sheep?
That's never been satisfactorily answered.
It hasn't, has it? I guess replicants count? Do androids count? Does Data, for example, count? But then Data started on the TV show, does he count? Mm. There aren't not a lot of robots in Star Trek, otherwise, really, are there? There's lots of alien species.
And, as you all know, Chris, from watching Star Trek Picard,
what
the android
done?
And artificial life was, of course, banned by the Federation after the attack on Mars. Which, of course, derailed the evacuation of the Romulan populace.
Which was a massive problem.
Yeah,
you know.
Logistically.
Yeah. Especially for the Romulan warrior nuns.
Oh, the Romulan warrior nuns.
So my answer is the robot from Rocky IV, which is just the greatest robot of all time, isn't it?
No.
No.
Paulie loves that robot, guys.
Paulie's an idiot.
This is
You're
true.
An idiot.
This is very true. Why did they have to take Mickey and they left Pauly?
Yeah, I should have had Metal Mickey. Remember them? Yeah. Classic children's television.
What's the robot from Buck Rogers that goes...
Tweaky. Beady. Here's a fact for you. When we did the first Empire iPad edition back in 2010, John Hitchcock and I, props to John, stayed up for many 24-hour shifts and slept in the office to try and hit the deadline to do it. And there was a little picture of Tweaky in it. And John made it so that when you press Tweaky, it just went beady. It was a little Easter egg.
Yeah, that's the sort of effort they put in at the beginning of the...
Yeah, and then we shat them out after that. But that first one was a masterpiece.
Yeah, regular listeners to the Empire podcast will know that feeling. It's like, oh, they put a lot of effort in at the beginning. Now they're just shitting them out. But there we go. That's that question answered to Felicity Kate's satisfaction, I'm sure. And if you want to have your question read out on the Empire podcast and answered by, frankly, a shadowy cabal of buffoons, then you could do so. You can get in touch with us via a number of methods. Where are we? We're on Twitter. It's at Empire Magazine. Use the hashtag Empire Podcast, or just wait for me to tweet panicked 5 minutes before we start a show going, I don't have a question, and then just send in a question. And then that's how we saw Felicity Kate's question this week. We're on Facebook, no one cares about that. And then we're on email as well. People do send in considered erudite questions to us on email, which I then ignore. But do send them in, podcast@empireonline.com. And hey, whilst we're telling you how to get in touch with us, another thing we'd like to ask you to do is to subscribe to our spoiler specials. Yes, in case some of you have missed it, and I think that many of you did miss it because we've only really talked about it once in the podcast and only really tweeted about it a couple of times. Our spoiler specials have been deemed to be so special and indeed spoilery that we have put them behind a paywall. Now, this paywall, people have been asking us, how do we subscribe to this paywall? What do we get in exchange for subscribing to this paywall? Well, I can tell you that for the princely sum of no more than £4.99 a month, you will never be charged more than £4.99 a month, you will get access to all our spoiler specials, the complete archive of spoiler specials, going all the way back to what I am told is an 8-minute long episode with Drew Goddard about The Cabin in the Woods, which is technically speaking a mini spoiler special, and maybe we should record an actual Cabin in the Woods spoiler special conversation to go around that and provide some ballast to that episode. That's a freebie. Don't care about that one. But, you know, from The Avengers onwards, all the way up to this week's spoiler specials, which are Queen and Slim and Parasite, with Birds of Prey and the Fantabulous Emancipation of One Harley Quinn, or as is now known apparently, Harley Quinn, Birds of Prey, to come next week as well. You will get a minimum of two spoiler specials, new and retro, every single month, and subscribers, people who've already subscribed since the paywall went up with 1917, will know that we are already exceeding that with the Parasite and the Birds of Prey and the Queen and Slim spoiler specials. You're already getting three this month, and we're hoping to continue that output and generate as many spoiler specials as we possibly can without me dying. So we would love you to come on this grand journey, this brave new dawn. Take this leap across the chasm with us. You can subscribe for the princely sum of £4.99 a month and get well over 100 incredible spoiler specials, including all of Chris McQuarrie, Mission Impossible, Rogue Nation of Fallout spoiler specials, all the Marvel Cinematic Universe spoiler specials we've done, all the Endgame spoiler specials, including the live show we did, all the interviews with the Russo brothers and Kevin Feige, and all those people will all be at your fingertips. How you subscribe is relatively simple. We have partnered with a company called Glow to provide the service to you. So if you go to glow.fm/empirefilm, that's glow.fm/empirefilm, enter your details, then you'll be able to choose your podcast app of choice. You will get a link, put it into your podcast app of choice, and therefore, as if by magic, over 100 spoiler specials will appear, and you will get the new spoiler specials as and when we roll them out. So one thing to point out, Glow is an American company, so when you go to that page, you will see that it's $6 a month or $60 a year, which is cheaper. I think that's how these things work out. But if you type in your payment details, you will be charged in UK money. You will be charged in UK sterling, and you will never be charged more than £4.99 a month. Exciting times. Hectic times, Jimbo.
Yes, they are.
They are. But we're excited about this, and we would love you to join us on this grand journey. Come with us. The water's lovely. All right, so now that the shameless plug is out of the way, it is time to talk about this week's, and let's be honest, last week's movie news as well, because last week was the live show. It was episode 400, an amazing live show we did at King's Place with an incredible sold-out audience and some pretty decent guests.
Some pretty great guests.
They were lovely. Steve Coogan, Michael Winterbottom, Emily Beecham, Todd Haynes.
Ben Travis.
Course, Ben Travis was there. and, of course, a special super-duper cameo right at the end by Christopher McQuarrie, which was a lot of fun. And we are very grateful to him for hightailing it all the way from the airport to come straight on the podcast. But because we recorded that on the Wednesday, and we don't like to go back in and record stuff after a live show, it kind of interrupts the flow of it a little bit. We weren't able to react to the major pieces of news that dropped in time-honored tradition immediately after we stopped recording the podcast. One of which is Joyous. Sam Raimi is going to direct Doctor Strange in the Multiverse of Madness, and one of which is very, very sad, the death of the legendary Kirk Douglas at the age of 103, which is a hell of an innings before edging it to first slip. There's been so much said about Kirk Douglas, good and bad, over the week or so since he passed away. What we can say is he had an incredible career in front of the camera. Ace in the Hole, Spartacus, The Vikings, Cactus Jack, cracking films all. So go and check him out. Oh, Out of the Past. That's another good one with Robert Mitchum. But yes, some cracking films indeed. And as I say, 103 is a ripe old age to get to. So RIP, Kirk Douglas. Now, the joyous news, Helen, is that Sam Raimi is back.
I knew you would be so happy about this. I saw this headline and I'm like, well, that seems awfully Chris. Is it Chris? Awfully Chris.
It's the most Chris.
I thought it might be the most Chris. I mean, you know, maybe like Sam Raimi directing Iron Man would be more Chris, but only just.
I think he's a much better fit for Doctor Strange.
Yeah, I agree.
So this is the news that Sam Raimi is going to, I mean, he was in talks. I mean, I don't think it's been officially confirmed, but pretty much once the Hollywood Papers of Record start talking about these things, and generally speaking, they're done deals. So obviously Scott Derrickson dropped out a few weeks ago from directing Doctor Strange in the Multiverse of Madness. And Marvel was still proceeding with that May release date next year, so they needed a director quick smart. And we talked about potential directors who could replace him, and I never suggested Raimi because I didn't think it would happen.
I was wondering whether he was going to do another film. How long has it been? It's 7 years since Oz the Great and Powerful.
It has indeed
been
7 years.
That was not his finest. hour.
It wasn't, but he did the Empire podcast then, and I think he just thought that's it.
Well, he peaked.
That's it. Yeah. It's all downhill from here.
More like we destroyed him at some point.
Yeah, we ruined Sam Raimi. Yeah, I think this is tremendously exciting news. He is the man who, obviously, with Spider-Man, helped pave the way for the Marvel Cinematic Universe. I think his visual sensibility and style, and the fact that he is one of the best horror directors around, will really work well for this movie, which apparently is still being billed as Marvel's first scary film. So that's going to be interesting. There's quite a bit of Raimi in the first Doctor Strange. Unintentionally or not, I remember whenever we had Scott Derrickson in for the spoiler special, we asked Scott Derrickson, I said, there's a bit in Doctor Strange's passage through the multiverse that feels very Evil Dead 2. And he went, what? So it's clearly unconscious.
Intentional.
So, but I think he's tremendous. He's one of my favorite directors, if not my favorite. He's certainly the director of my favorite movie of all time. A little film I like to call Evil Dead 2, Dead by Dawn. And I'm very excited about this as well. And he's clearly worked with Kevin Feige before. So yeah, why not? Why not bring him aboard? And let's ignore the fact his last movie was also great and powerful. And let's ignore the fact his last comic book movie was Spider-Man 3. And let's hope that this is the Sam Raimi of the Evil Dead movies, and the Sam Raimi of the first two Spider-Mans, and the Sam Raimi of The Quick and the Dead, and the Sam Raimi of Darkman, and the Sam Raimi of Drag Me to Hell. If that Sam Raimi shows up in his impeccable blue suit with his incredible manners, then we are going to be in for a treat.
Do you think we should have some kind of suit-off between Sam Raimi, Paul Feig, and...
I think Paul Feig would win.
I think Paul Feig would win, yeah.
Christopher Nolan
was my third entry, but Paul Feig is the best dressed.
Yeah, because he actually goes to Savile Row.
Does he?
Yeah, he does.
Of course he does.
Does he really?
He does.
Yeah, his suits are, like, gorgeous.
What type are they?
Like, I mean, interesting fabrics, fabulous linings, he does the pocket square, like, he's... Mm.
Savile Row.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Rumour has it, Arafat buys his there.
I don't think he goes to that exact... what was the name of that tailor?
John Phillips, London.
You giant nerds. You nerdy nerds. I love it. The Knives Out sequel is officially happening.
I have two myself.
So what are we calling it? Knives In?
Knives In.
Yeah.
Knives.
Knives Chow. It's a Scott Pilgrim crossover.
I don't know who said this on Twitter. My favourite one was Knives Out 2, No Forks Given.
Wow.
Wow.
Bar is pretty low when it comes to impressing.
Well, I liked it.
I was working on some kind of Point Blank.
That's good. Hey. That's good.
Gross Point Blank.
Better.
But it could.
That is good. Yeah. Very excited about this. People are obviously doing their dream casts as well. Mm-hmm. Someone said the other day to Rian Johnson on Twitter, wouldn't it be fun if you made a whole bunch of Benoit Blanc movies and then every single one he had a different accent and it was never commented on? And Rian Johnson replied, actually, that has crossed my mind from time to time.
It would be hilarious.
And he just turns up in a different city with a different cast every time. As much as I loved Ana de Armas in that movie, I do not want to see Marta in this. I do not want that character.
Yeah, I think it should be,
if he announces a cast tomorrow and it does continue Marta's journey and she somehow gets mixed up in another murder mystery and Benoit Blanc's on the scene again, I'm totally there for it because she's great. But
it shouldn't be dragging her into it for no reason.
Absolutely.
Wes Anderson's, speaking of dreamy casts, Wes Anderson's The French Dispatch got a trailer this week.
He's made his film again.
There is a bit of that. But at the same time, like, his film is often a lot of fun. And this is a fantastic, fantastic group of people and a ridiculous, ridiculous setup. So I'm super there for it. So it's all apparently basically based on New Yorker figures of history and sort of some New Yorker stories, but obviously given a completely zany, crazy spin with Bill Murray, Owen Wilson, Tilda Swinton, Frances McDormand, Adrian Brody, Benicio del Toro, Jeffrey Wright, Lea Seydoux, Timothy Chalamet.
You could fade out
Angelica
and come back and get 4 hours later.
It's pretty great. So it's Edward Norton, Willem Dafoe, Elizabeth
It's a tremendous Ball. Cast. I did, however, I had a sense of ennui watching the trailer. It was just like...
Well, that's because it's set in Ennui-sur-Blasé. That's the name of the metropolis.
That's
where
precisely what I was aiming at, Helen.
I know that's what you meant, Chris. Look, I still think that The Royal Tenenbaums is his best film, and I don't think it's very close. But I
think Grand Budapest Hotel is great. I was wrong. I don't know what I was thinking.
I've just never quite understood. Maybe I need to watch that film again, but I've always been really blah on that film.
Yeah, someone else said that to me yesterday. I killed them too. No, I think Ralph Fiennes is tremendous in that film. But
yes, he is.
There's something, there's the archness of Anderson's style, the way it's evolved now. This looks like almost like a Wes Anderson parody in a weird way. I'm sure it'll be fine. I'm sure it'll be okay. Maybe it'll be fun.
Also, in trailer news, we had the first look at Gangs of London from Gareth Evans, which looks super violent.
It does. It's a Sky original TV show.
It is indeed.
So I'm sure you'll be discussing that, James, on a future episode of the Pilot TV podcast.
You're mocking me, aren't you?
Very much so, yeah.
Excellent. Excellent. Yes. Yes, we will.
Good. Yeah, it looks good. Corin Hardy and Xavier Shans also directed a load of episodes for LAT. Mm-hmm. So it looks very, very cool. One trailer we didn't talk about last week, it actually hit just in time for us to discuss it on the live pod, but time was against us, is the first look at Spiral. The movie we now know to be called Spiral from the Book of Saw, which is the Chris Rock Saw movie. That's right. I'll say that again. The Chris Rock Samuel L. Jackson Saw movie. I'll say that again. The Chris Rock Samuel L. Jackson Saw movie that was actually thought up by Chris Rock.
Yeah.
What's going on?
I don't know, but I don't know. I was about to say I'm here for it, and actually statistically I have not been here for all the Saw movies to date. What with them being scary. So so I might be here for it. I probably will be here for it. I'm intrigued by this one in a way I haven't been by most of them.
This one looks interesting in that it looks like a kind of classier Saw movie. And you don't get a sense necessarily that it's a full-blown Saw movie until kind of near the end. How does it play in? Why is it called Spiral from the Book of Saw? The title intrigues me. Mm. Chris Rock doing dramatic stuff. He's in Fargo season 4 as well. Yeah. Dramatic stuff intrigues me. Sam Jackson gets to say motherfuckers in the trailer. That intrigues me. All good. Yeah, it looks, looks fine.
Yep.
Darren Lynn Bousman, who directed, I think, Saw's 2 through 6, is back to direct this one as well. So, yarr.
Let's quickly try and wrap up the trailers, but Green Knight, David Lowery.
I haven't seen it yet. I'm very excited about
film. Yeah, it looks gorgeous. I have nothing really to go on beyond that, but I am here for the looks. It looks beautiful. So, hooray for that.
Hooray.
And there was a camera test, of course, for Matt Reeves' The Batman.
Yes. Indeed there was. Our bats in the cape, in the cowl. That was a look. What I found funny about that is I thought he looked absolutely fine. I had no issue with it. The amount of people on Reeves' responses to his Twitter post going, "This is not my Batman. Ben Affleck is my Batman," and posting sort of pictures of like Batfleck next to him. "This is the real Batman." I'm like, I'm sorry. Like, when did Batfleck's Batman become the bar Batman for Batman? Like, when did this happen? Like, this is not a thing.
He's a perfectly good Batman.
He's fine, but he's not the Batman. Like,
no,
he's not.
It comes from the cult. It comes from the Snyder Cut.
It's the Snyder Cut.
Yeah, but also if you went back to the time that they released their first picture of sad Batman, those same people would probably be saying, "This isn't my Batman. Christian Bale is my Batman."
Yeah, but it is kind of like, it's Keaton or Bale, isn't it? You know, let's not fuck about it. You can pick one of those. But no one's saying that Ben Affleck is the best Batman. He's a perfectly serviceable Batman. But, you know.
It's Lego.
Let's not overstate this shit. Oh, come now, Helen. I have absolutely no time for fucking Lego Batman.
I do.
Neither big nor funny nor entertaining.
All three. But it is a different look to the suit. There's a sort of collar around the cape, which almost makes him look, in this tiny little silhouette that we have, he looks a bit night owl to me.
It's formal wear.
Oh, is it?
Yeah, he's going to a party.
It's so important to be properly dressed. And as we all know, the Batman has suits for every occasion. So.
And people have also noticed that the bat symbol on his chest, which doesn't have the little pointy ears on the, it doesn't have the little pointy bat face, seems to be made of metal, and people are surmising that it's going to be the gun that killed his parents that he has had melted down and turned.
Oh, is that a cannon thing?
Yeah, it's a gun, not a cannon. But no, it's apparently it is canon in certain comic books, so they may have adapted for this. No one's confirming or denying anything at this point in time, but that just. If that's the case, that just, I did a tweet about it this morning going, what if Batman just, you know, got over it? What if he just, at one point in his life, he just goes, you know what? I'm actually okay. I'm at peace with the fact that my parents died. I'm all right with it. Stop going on about it, you boring bastard.
I feel like if that's true, if that's the canonical explanation for that bat symbol on his chest, and we are only told that in interviews before it happens, it is not referred to in the film, and that is the only reference in the film to the sad death of his parents in Crime Alley all those years ago with their fake pearls, then fine. If this indicates that we are going to see them die one more fucking time...
I hope we do.
Then I'm not so fine.
I hope it goes full Groundhog Day.
Oh, God.
I hope we get to see it 573 times. The Waynes locked into an endless time loop, and they know each time... that they walk into that alley, they're going to die, and there's nothing they can do about it. Now, that's romantic.
Speaking of romance, there's the new Bond theme.
There is. What do we think of it?
I quite liked it.
Yeah, so did I. It's very there was lots of, it's like every other Bond film. Well, obviously it has a Bondian vibe, because it's a fucking Bond theme. But I really liked it. I'm there for it. Mm. The only one who's ever attempted to make a banger out of a Bond theme is Madonna, and that did not go very well.
That's quite like palpably not true.
You know, Palpatine not true.
It's Palpatine not true. Palpatine.
No, you know what I mean.
Theme.
Like where it's like Bond in Ibiza. Like that was an unexpected turn.
Bond in Ibiza.
Yes, Die Another Day. It's a fucking dance anthem.
Bradley gets out of first gear, that song. It's not like Bond.
Wait for the drop.
It's not like DJ Sasha or Digweed or one of these.
I love
people.
The way you're scraping around in your brain for the name of people.
I'm not even sure if Digweed's a real person. I just hear Digweed, talking about him in the office. Mm. Sasha and Digweed.
Yeah.
It's like his football manager is the indefatigable Hawthorne and his enigmatic assistant Romley.
I don't know what you're talking about.
Anyway, it's an in joke. Anyway, Paul McCartney, Live and the Die is a fucking banger. Chris Cornell, You Know My Name is a banger.
Yeah, okay, perhaps I should not have used the word banger. I'm thinking more in terms of...
You've got a knife to a gunfight here, son.
Yeah, I have, clearly.
That's your problem.
Yeah.
I've only heard it a couple of times, so it's hard for me to judge, but I'm intrigued to see whether this continues the pattern. I haven't decided whether the song's good or bad yet. It's better than Sam Smith, but frankly...
Which won an Oscar.
Yeah. But frankly, shoving a gibbon into a sack and then throwing that gibbon down some stairs would have resulted in a
sack gibbon stair music is an underappreciated genre.
I don't hate that one as much as...
Oh, it's fucking terrible. Sam. Can I just say, though, the Empire Podcast does not condone the stuffing of gibbons into sacks and then chucking them downstairs.
Thanks, Chris. As your lawyer, I appreciate it.
Or into Zach's.
Oh no, definitely not. Thanks, James, for making that
release the Snyder Cut.
But so far the Craig films have been a great theme tune.
Great theme
Casino
tune.
Royale, great film.
You Know My Name.
The Jack White, Alicia Keys song.
Don't mind it.
Oh, I see. You're not helping
it's
my
not
theory
good.
Here, Helen. From
the
Quantum
film
of Solace.
Terrible, though.
What's the song called? Another Way to Die.
Another Way to Die.
Okay, Another Way to Die. Rubbish song. Rubbish film. Skyfall, great
song. I don't like it.
Great film.
I like the film, I don't like the song.
Written in the Wind, or whatever the hell it's called. We Had the Stars. What's the song called from Spectre? Writing's on the Wall.
Writing's on the Wall.
Terrible song, not great film. Great moments. Spectre is decent, but it's just not as good as what came before.
What's the best Bond song?
Well, it's You Know My Name.
Diamonds Are Forever.
I've answered this. I've answered this at length.
Not true.
I've answered this at length on Jeremy Dillon's My Favorite Album podcast. We did a Bond theme special.
The correct answer is A View to a Kill.
You're an idiot.
A View to a Kill.
You can't diss Cornell
I can, and I did.
If you'd said License to Kill, I could have respected
License
you.
License to Kill.
That's good. That's a good shout. That's a good shout.
View to a
Live
Kill,
and Let Die, obviously,
please.
As well.
The key change in License to Kill at the end, where
God.
It's like, oh, I got a license to kill, and then
kill.
Boom, and you know, bam, bam, going, bam, bam. Oh,
it's so good.
Of course, my favorite is GoldenEye.
Of course, it is.
I cannot stress you enough, listeners. I cannot stress you enough that you have not lived until you have heard James Dyer sing GoldenEye at karaoke.
Our Bondioki, where we did karaoke Bond and we went through all the Bond songs. I like to think my GoldenEye did bring the house down. In many ways, literally.
Yeah, they still haven't rebuilt. Yeah.
Anyway, jury's out still, but it's fine. It's fine. It's no Radiohead, but there you go. What can you do? But yes, what else has happened? Oh, the Oscars happened. We should probably talk about that.
And just quickly before we do the Oscars, can we mention Rick Moranis? Rick Moranis.
We can mention Rick Moranis before or after the Oscars.
Yeah, he's, well, I know, but you know, the Oscars seem big. But Rick Moranis is coming back to Honey, I Shrunk the Kids. They're rebooting it with Josh Gad starring as, like, presumably the family dad who shrinks the kids. And Moranis is going to be back, and I'm just delighted because I love him. And by all accounts, especially by Nick's account, he was a delight when Nick interviewed him a couple of years ago. He is one of the nicest men in Hollywood, or lately not in Hollywood, and it's absolutely great to hear that he might be back in films again.
Absolutely. He's been Rick-less Annis for far too long, and now I'm delighted that he's more Annis again.
Yeah. Okay.
But yeah, this is good. So apparently he's going to be Wayne Szalinski once again.
Hooray!
Well, what's interesting is that he said yes to this, but he turned down a chance to appear in Ghostbusters.
I mean, maybe it was just timing-wise or something like that. We don't know. Mm. But, I'm surprised. He was a supporting character in Ghostbusters and, I guess, the lead in this. Maybe that makes a difference. But
He had pretty emphatically retired. So what has Gad said that gadding about? Because Gad said, you know, he said that Gad has had a lot to do with it. That, you know, Gad has kind of personally recruited him.
Maybe that was the difference. But, you know, look, he stepped back because his wife died and he wanted to raise his kids. So I think, you know, it's the most sympathetic and commendable reason I think anyone in Hollywood has ever had
without
for retiring. I mean, they literally did want to spend more time with his family, and no one can criticize him for that. But at the same time, we have missed him, so I think it'll be great to see him back on the big screen.
Couple of other bits and pieces, little bits and bobs to talk about before we get into the Oscars. So Gugu Mbatha-Raw, who is tremendous, has been added to the cast of Loki, the Disney Plus show, which will star Tom Hiddleston as Loki. We don't know who she's going to play yet, but anything in which Gugu Mbatha-Raw can appear is a good thing.
Joins Owen Wilson in the cast for that.
Wow.
As an exclusive clip from the show, just for you, Empire Podcast listeners.
Loki does something evil, and then Wilson just goes, wow.
Man, whoa.
Wow. Tom Hiddleston does an impression of Owen Wilson, actually.
Well, in the show, it's unexpected.
Yeah, he might do, actually, because Loki's so capricious. What a jokester. So excited about that. And we also have a co-writer has been brought on to Thor, Love and Thunder. The story said that Jennifer Caton Robinson has been brought on to a phrase which, quite frankly, upsets me, the writing staff of Thor, Love and Thunder. I don't think that these things should be written by committee, although that's obviously the way that it is going. And I'm sure Taika Waititi is still taking the lead on that project. And we shouldn't read anything bad into the fact that a writer was brought on to Doctor Strange in the Multiverse of Madness just mere months before Scott Derrickson jumped ship. Hopefully this is all going to be fine and this is just routine and above board.
Maybe it's one writer for each verse in the multiverse and each one tackles a different reality.
Thanks, James.
Let's go with that.
James Bowen is in talks to direct the Clue remake.
Yes.
Ryan Reynolds.
Replacing Jason Bateman, who dropped out of both starring and directing duties. James Bowen is unlikely to star, I'd say. But if you want a tall, bumbling Englishman in your... Well, actually, you could get you, James, couldn't you?
That's true.
Yeah.
I am available.
You're not so much bumbling, more just malevolent. But
it could be an interesting new spin.
Yes. James Wilburn, a good director, directed both the Muppets movies, has a fine sense of whimsy and the surreal, so this could work very nicely.
Yeah.
Or it could be one of those projects that never really gets the starting grid. Who knows? What else?
Dee Reese has announced her new film. She's going to be directing a new adaptation of Porky and Bess. So that's really exciting as well. I'm not entirely clear on exactly what we can expect. She said she's going to recite it at a place and moment of resistance. So that's kind of interesting. I don't know, that could mean the civil rights era or something like that, but it's potentially a new spin on the material. But it is a beautiful story, and I'm looking forward to that.
Excellent.
Okay, all exciting stuff. And then the Oscars happened. Talk about that.
Helen.
Yeah, they did. Hi.
The Oscars happened.
I was pleased. Mostly.
Were you now?
Yeah.
It was unexpected, I would say.
It was my hope, as you know. I said it last week.
Yeah. But we had those leaks from the Academy voters, which were just an absolute dumpster fire of nonsense.
Those are never a really good predictor because they do find
the worst,
the fucking weirdos,
the
very worst of humanity for those. But at the same time, it did look like. Parasite might be just a bridge too far. It looked like the same kind of...
No, bridge too far was ages ago.
Thanks, Chris. It looked like it might be the same kind of conservative forces that voted for this list of acting nominees that might sort of win the day and vote for something, you know, very good, but more safe and more kind of... predictable, like 1917. And instead, they didn't. They went for what I think is legitimately one of the best films of last year, which is unbelievable. It is the first time that the Oscars and the Cannes Film Festival have collided in their big prize since, I think, what, Marty in the, was that 50s or early 60s?
Marty! In 1955.
55. At 55, man. It's crazy. It is historic. It's obviously a massive, massive win, not just for cinema, for rightness, for Bong Joon-ho, for Korea, South Korea, I mean,
And
thank you. And loads of people actually asking about South Korean films suddenly and making lists of other ones you might want to watch, which is good because some of them are freaking fantastic. So I think it's great, great, great news. The acting categories went exactly as we expected. So did most of the technical categories. There was another outrageous and egregious snub to Marvel after the... After the BAFTAs made that baffling decision with the clips last week, the Oscars then...
What did they do?
Oh, they cut... They did the scene where Cap catches the hammer and says, Avengers, assemble, as everybody's come out of portals, right? But they cut before he said assemble. And I swear to God, like, everyone watching at home was just like... Ah! It was like you had to watch the film then.
It was like shaving a haircut, just like...
Yes!
No, you were like Roger Rabbit, like clawing at the walls.
This is why we should never let Martin Scorsese edit these clips.
Honestly, it was so upsetting.
All right, so the snub, I can't believe we're searing in this, but the snub that you're talking about, so Avengers Endgame, the biggest movie of all time, the movie that changed my life, I will call any child I have portals, was nominated for one Oscar, Best Visual Effects. It lost to 1917. The effing hell?
I do appreciate that the Oscars do now seem able to spot that invisible visual effects, if you will, are still visual effects. That the visual effects that are not about aliens and superheroes and so on are also visual effects. What gets me is in this case, like, Avengers has all of that too. It has the invisible visual effects and the big showy visual effects. It does them both really well. What the hell, guys?
Honestly, what? I'm boycotting the Oscars until I'm nominated.
I saw a visual effects thing. I'm going to jump in. This is a slight tangent, but I will feel I want to mention it. Henry Cavill was on Twitter recently.
He is entirely CG. This is
great. He is, and it turns out he's an entirely CG character. No, he was talking through the Battle of Blaviken from The Witcher, and he showed the sequence. It's incredibly, incredibly choreographed sword fight, and the whole way through it, he has half a sword, and that's why the choreography is so good. It's a half, and then they CG in the rest of the sword, and that's why he's able to be completely nuts in it and not worry about decapitating people that he's fighting. I thought that was really, that blew my mind. It's a really subtle thing, you would never know it, but just they CG in the rest of his sword, and the people who attack him with axes, they're just sticks, and they put the axe heads on afterwards.
Which half does he have?
He's got the hand-holdy bit.
No, he's got the end of it.
Yeah, it's just a point floating about 2 feet from his hand.
Mm. Because then you would have problems, wouldn't you, with like spatial awareness, and so do they? Yeah. Does the sword magically get longer sometimes if he just misses?
Only if he gets excited.
Yeah. Wow.
But also it is sensible because if they use the rubber swords that they usually use for fight scenes, you do sometimes see those bend.
Yeah.
Like,
boing, boing, boing.
We have all seen this in really major movies.
I saw,
where sometimes the weapons bend.
I saw Upstart Crow the other night on the West End stage. The adaptation, the hit West End adaptation of the televisual sitcom by Ben Elton, starring David Mitchell as William Shakespeare. And it's fantastic, but at one point it's a sword fight and then someone... uses a sword to get themselves up and the sword goes boing, like that. It's like, okay.
I went to see Endgame at the Old Vic, which sadly was not related to the Avengers.
I'd love to see Daniel Radcliffe going on your left.
Oh my God, can you imagine? It'd be great.
Then everyone from all the other Beckett plays appears.
Godo finally arrives.
Yeah, I'm here. You wanted more? Anyway. Yes. So the Oscars. Parasite won Best Picture and Best Director. Best Actress was Renee Zellweger for Judy. Joaquin Phoenix for a popular winner for Joker. I'm just going through here on the list of winners, so that's going to be a little bit out of whack. So the Best Original Song went to Elton John for I'm Gonna Love Me Again and Bernie Taupin as well.
That's actually the Glasgow No Place Like Home Award for Best Original Song.
That would have been the best song in there, yes, had it been nominated. Yes. It's a decent song. It's not Elton at his finest, but hey ho, at least Elton John has an Oscar now. Joker, Hildur Gotnadottir, won for Lad for Best Original
That's
Score.
Right. Mm.
Parasite, because it was greedy, won Best International Feature Film. Best Makeup and Hair is Bombshell. That's a bombshell.
Fair. That's the only category that film should really have been nominated in. That, mm-hmm, that makeup was astonishing.
Best Visual Effects is 1917. Best Film Editing was Ford versus Ferrari. Best Sound Mixing was 1917. Best Sound Editing, Ford versus Ferrari. Best Cinematography, The Deeks.
The Deeks.
He's picked up his second Oscar. He's making up for lost time.
It's like you wait ages for an Oscar. You wait like 14 nominations and then two come along.
I know the feeling.
Two.
Best Supporting Actress was Laura Dern for Marriage Story. Best Documentary Short was Learning to Skateboard in a War Zone, brackets, If You're a Girl, close brackets.
Great
Best
title.
Documentary was American Factory, which I haven't seen. I don't think it's been released over
it's
here,
good.
Has it?
No, it's on Netflix.
It's on Netflix. Oh, I would check it out. Because
mm-hmm.
I thought For Samuel was going to win that one. Best Costume Design was Little Women, only little. And Best Production Design was Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. Best Animated Short is Hair Love.
Which is delightful. If you
fantastic.
Haven't seen that, I really recommend it.
Absolutely
it's on
fantastic.
YouTube.
There's an amazing story behind this as well if you haven't seen it, but Matthew A. Cherry, who wrote and directed the short, won an Oscar for it, basically said 3 years ago he put up an image of a young black girl with her father and he was doing her hair and he said any 3D artists out there, CG artists out there, hit me up because I've got an Oscar winning short to build around this image, and lo and behold, it's like Noel Edmonds. You ask the universe for something, the universe will give you something back. Best live action short was A Neighbor's Window, which is a spin off from Neighbors. The best adapted screenplay was Jojo Rabbit. Interesting.
Yeah.
Best original screenplay was not Knives Out or Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. It was indeed Parasite.
Mm.
Best animated feature was Toy Story 4, and best supporting actor was William Bradley Pitt for Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. Amon, what did you think of that?
Amon's here.
Hello, everybody. The one which hits out to me, because I'm me, Thomas Newman has been nominated now 15 times for an Oscar. He has not won once.
Thomas Newman, more like.
Which is just insane.
What was it up for this year?
1917,
which is a fantastic score. Mm. I can't sort of, get too mad at it because a female composer won and a female composers are rare to begin with, not to mention sort of winning the Oscar. So I can't get too mad at that. I was ecstatic at Parasite winning.
Yeah.
I came this close to waking up everybody on my street. I was just, it was great. Yeah.
Fair play. Yeah, I was fast asleep.
No,
I missed the whole thing.
That Bong Joon-ho winning that and Best Director, which was easily the best speech on the night, by the way, that sort of standing ovation from Martin Scorsese was just, that's why we watch the Oscars, is for moments like that. And yeah, I was very, very happy. Have you seen Parasite yet?
Yes.
Okay, good. Well, yeah, because last time we spoke, we hadn't in ours. It's like, but yeah, it's a fantastic, fantastic movie, and long. It's insane that it's taken 92 years for the Oscars to award a non-English language film the best picture.
Now they've ticked that box. It'll be another 92. Most likely.
Yeah. Well, see, here's the thing: like they followed up Moonlight with Green Book. So now we have Parasite. I'm a little bit scared about what's going to happen next year.
It's a real worry, actually.
That really is. Marge, my dear, I haven't learned a thing.
You know what I'm
that's very
progress
much that,
is not
it?
A straight line. And then the other sort of, I guess, takeaway is that, you know, obviously we should and we will celebrate Parasite's win, but the Oscars still have a long way to go in terms of Asian representation. The fact that Parasite won all the awards and none of the actors have been nominated for any acting awards the entire award season is a travesty.
Yeah, it's a bit weird. So, didn't they win? They won ensemble.
They won the best ensemble.
Sucks,
yes.
Yeah. But otherwise, yeah.
But yeah, I mean, Song Kang-ho definitely deserves a nomination.
I also thought one of my favorite speeches of the night actually was Brad Pitt's. because I thought it was a really beautiful mix of, so he got up there, he opened with a political joke about the impeachment. He went on to call for stunt Oscars, which is a long overdue injustice. He was sincere and, you know, thanked people involved in making the film and in his life in general. And he was just delightful, I thought. And it was a really nice little, not overlong Oscar speech that I think more people should do that.
Aside from Parasite and the speeches, the highlight of the night, of course, was Eminem's performance.
What was that about?
It was totally random, but it was worth it for all the new GIF content we now have of people losing their minds to Eminem. It was great. Including Martin Scorsese, he was having a well of a time with that.
Oh yeah, he was. You could tell because he wasn't moving at all, and was completely blank face.
Yeah,
his eyebrows were flailing around as if independent from his body.
And yes, I still know all the lyrics to that song. It still slaps.
Mm-hmm. Go on then.
Oh boy, I put myself on the spot.
Knees weak, arms are heavy. There's vomit on his sweater already. Mom's spaghetti. He's nervous. I'm on the surface.
If you get one shot.
One opportunity to seize everything you ever wanted.
Would you take it?
Okay, I'm happy. Oh, yeah, that's fine.
Yes!
You've proved it to me.
Let's go karaoke, everybody.
Yeah, let's sack off the rest of the podcast. Let's not do Birds of Prey. Let's go karaoke.
Honestly, I think it would be a relief for everybody.
Yeah. What's your karaoke song of choice, Simon?
Don't stop believing.
Oh, really?
I love S Club.
I actually did that fairly recently. And then I also, once I did it, I dropped the mic. It was a moment.
And then you got in trouble, didn't you, for dropping the mic?
A little bit, yeah. Worth it. This is a true story, I promise.
Oh, my good God.
All right, okay. Have you ever seen his GoldenEye? That's not a sex thing. It's
No.
It's intensely problematic, it's also fear me, Amon. It's also
dread it,
very,
run
very
from
funny.
It.
James's GoldenEye arrives all the same. Anyway.
Have we discussed the new Bond song?
We have.
Oh, what did you want to say, though?
Go on then.
No, it's
you're really
good.
Pro.
Great,
thanks, Amon. Thanks for coming.
As I tweeted, the best Bond song of the Craig era is Celine Dion, Ashes. I'm not sure if he said that. have I repeated it? Yeah, he said that.
Yeah, correct. You've blown Chris's mind. I mean, you know, he's right. It is during the Bond era. It is clearly a Bond song, ergo, on Amon's definition.
I'm the first one to say this, aren't I?
Best Bond song that's not a Bond song, I've said this before, is Fighting Suspicions by Rebecca Ferguson. Check it out. It's a banger.
What about Rise Like a Phoenix by Conchita at the Eurovision that time?
What about Firework by Katy Perry?
No.
Sorry, it's just the way we're listening songs. Anyway, Amon has arrived because we're about to do the Birds of Prey spoiler special, but we're also going to be discussing some films that are out, not a lot this week, quite frankly. There were loads last week and there'll be loads coming up next week, but there's only a couple of films this week to discuss. We'll be doing that right after I introduce our guest this week. So exciting.
Wow.
It is so exciting because our guest this week is the legendary, the iconic Emilio Estevez.
Ooh, yay.
That is correct. Emilio Estevez. He is, of course, the star of Young Guns, The Mighty Ducks.
Freaking love Young Guns.
Men at Work. Help me, I'm running out of video.
Sunil Muspayar, wasn't he?
Let's go for that. Yes, he is the son, of course, of Martin Sheen. The brother, of course, of Carlos Estevez as well. Better known, of course, as Charlie Sheen. Mm-hmm. Hashtag winning. Hashtag Tiger Blood. Hashtag topical. And he's back with a film that's out next week called The Public, which he wrote, directed, and starred in as well. And at the top of the show, I mentioned that he was also the subject of one of my favorite ever Twitter jokes as well by @shockproofbeats. It simply says, November 16th, 2012, I'd love to get in touch with Emilio Estevez. Does anyone have his Emilio Adrestevez?
That's genius.
That's top 10. That's top 10 of all time. I also love the one, I can't remember who wrote it, but it's a guy going, sweet dreams, you piece of shit, I say to the prison guard, intending to snap his neck, but instead I just make him look quickly to the left. which is an amazing, amazing tweet. Anyway, Emilio Estevez, he's got this film out called The Public. It's out next week. And He came into London last year to talk about this movie, and we sent along the boss. Not Bruce Springsteen. He was too busy talking to me and Ben Travis at the time. Instead, the boss, Terry White, who has now departed the shores to have a baby, which is frankly selfish if you ask me. But she did this interview. It was her first interview on her own in the field using the recording equipment. And I assume it came out okay. I'm not editing this one. So fingers crossed that this is, in theory, Terry White talking to Emilio Estevez. Enjoy.
Emilio Estevez, hello.
Yes, hello. How are you?
I'm all right, actually. Good. How are you?
Excellent. Thank you.
Yeah. Well, we are here to talk about The Public, which is your film about a standoff that occurs when homeless people stage a sit-in in a public library in Cincinnati.
Cincinnati, Ohio.
Cincinnati, as I hear it's called in America.
Well, it's named after Cincinnatius. So you were actually close. It's the Roman conqueror and emperor.
Or I actually, think I was correct.
Yeah, you were correct.
I was basically correct.
Yeah, no, you were dialed in. Yeah, you were.
Excellent.
You were channeling Cincinnatius.
Cincinnatius, as it shall now be called. But I want to start with an important question first, which is, do you support Millwall?
Good Lord. Millwall. Never heard of them. They're a football club, right?
They are.
No.
Soccer, I believe
right,
you call
soccer
it.
Soccer, as we call it, and is in truth, the former chairman, Stuart Till, and I have worked together. We worked together on a film called The Way, which his company, Icon International, was distributing. And so Stuart, and we were friends before that. And so Stuart says, well, I'm going to put your name on a Millwall jersey and I'm going to send it to you. And so, and at the time I had a Twitter account, which I don't anymore, and it's one of the reasons. So I had a friend of mine take a photo of me wearing the jersey, and I posted it, not realizing what an absolute shitstorm it would create, and the haters, and it, of course I understand that football clubs and the fans they're mad, and it's very competitive and very aggressive, but I get that, but all I did was put on a jersey, man.
It's a big deal.
Yeah, yeah. So my reasons for quitting Twitter, that is one of them. Mm. And the other was I had a couple of pops one night when the Ducks were playing the Hawks, the Chicago Blackhawks, and it was a semifinal. And I maybe it was my third or fourth, fifth tequila. And so I started live tweeting during the course of the game, and the Ducks won. And I'd been taking such heat from the Chicago fans that I couldn't take it anymore, or it was the tequila talking.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, "Suck it, you Windy City windbags," and just shy of death threats. So after that, I thought, you know, I got to hang up this Twitter thing. It's not worth it. I'm just too careless. And it wouldn't be the first time that someone's been handed or hoisted on their own petard, as they say, for an improper tweet. And so I thought, yeah, this is not a good match. And so I created the account shortly thereafter. So between Millwall and the Ducks, you cannot find me on Twitter.
I did search for you, I have to tell you. And yeah. I was like, there's something's afoot.
Right.
Something's afoot, yeah. A Millwall jersey. Is what's the foot.
And I think there's probably somewhere where that photo exists. I'm sure someone
I found it earlier.
See?
You have slightly longer hair, right?
Yes, I longer hair. I think at the time I had just done The Way, or I was holding on to that long hair from The Way. So yeah, I was in The Way mode.
It's a very lovely picture. I've saved it on my phone.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah.
Oh, thank you.
I'll look at it once a day for the rest of my life.
Oh.
Probably.
Thank you.
Is that weird?
No. I love the film because it's inspired so many people to get off their couch and go walk 800 kilometers across the northern part of Spain. And I may, in truth, never make another film that has that sort of impact and that sort of inspiration for people to physically leave their home and do something they would never dream of.
So this was The Pilgrim Across North Spain, right?
That's right. That's right.
And this was 2010.
It came out here in 2010. And in the States in 2011. And we did a very unconventional release of the film in the States where I we did a pilgrimage of another sort. We got on a bus that we did we shrink wrapped the exterior of the bus with the poster of the film. I loaded my father and the producer of the film and my son, and we went across the country. We visited about 30 different cities, and we did two screenings a night, one secular, one non, Q&As afterwards. Mm. We didn't vet any of the questions. It was an extraordinary experience. The last city that we visited was Cincinnati. Mm. Or Cincinnatius.
Cincinnatius.
We visited Cincinnati, and the film director there said, would you stay and see what Cincinnati has to offer? Because I think you would find a very welcome place to shoot your next film. And that was the Public. It took a couple years to get it up and running, but once it was decided that we would move the location to Cincinnati, it proved to be a good move.
Well, you say a couple of years, 12.
Mm. 12 years in total.
13 right. In April.
Yeah, yeah.
So why 12?
Well, you've got to imagine that here it is in, 2000. Well, I first wrote this in 2008. There you are in visiting or meeting with studio executives and independent film financiers, and you're saying, I'm going to make this movie that takes place in a library, and it's going to deal with homelessness and the climate crisis and mental illness and the opioid addiction, and there's the door, right? Mm-hmm. There's the door, young man. And so I it was not an easy sell. And then, of course, the economic crisis hit in 2008, and we were semi-funded, but we had to put it on hold. And I had to rethink what was next. And what was next was actually fortuitous, because what was next was The Way. Did The Way, and then came back to the Public in the new iteration. And in a new world, really, because the first version of the script was written in under an administration that was decidedly darker. Mm. It was a more paranoid time. We now had a new president in office. Things seemed hopeful and more, and there was a bright, sunshiny day, it seemed, and so the script reflected that, and it was and ultimately a much more hopeful and much more entertaining movie than the previous script had been. Mm. So I'm sometimes projects are on their own time, and I think when you try to force them, the universe has a way of saying, hang on, right? I've forced other projects before they were ready, including the first movie I directed, which had no business being made. It was like a first draft of a script that needed a hell of a lot more work. And instead we went off and shot it. And I was 23 years old and arrogant and stupid, and no one was going to tell me what to do. So I had a spectacular fall with that first effort. And I was resigned to learn a lesson there. I kind of did. So here we are, with the benefit, to go back to your original question. Yeah, the benefit of having that extra decade to make the film.
And it is kind of more, whether it's prescient or relevant, however we want to describe it in this age. So was there kind of the benefit of time as actually, do you think the film is coming out in a better climate? Well, not better.
Right. Well, yes, it certainly feels more relevant. However, it doesn't feel like the times are reflective of a compassionate or empathetic moment. Mm. That was my hope, is that we would land in a place with this movie at a time where people would be open to looking at this and this issue from a different perspective. But I think we are, this is a movie that celebrates the marginalized, and it is about so many things. Mm-hmm. It is a fully baked cake. I mean, we deal with the climate crisis. We deal with homelessness and mental illness and opioid addiction and essentially all the things that you see in the newspaper every day that you open it. And so I think that there's probably an overload. People feel overwhelmed by seeing all of these things. They didn't maybe not necessarily want to see them reflected in their entertainment choice. However, you've seen the movie, you know it's wildly entertaining, even given the fact that it does tackle a lot of these
it's
very
funny.
Important, and it is funny, unexpectedly funny. And that now I've screened the movie in the United States about 50 times with audiences as small as 100 and upwards of 2,000. And the laughs that come are people walk out of it saying, I did not expect it to be that funny. That really opened my eyes. And what has happened since the release and then the DVD release, and again, we've been out a while in the States, is that it has created a conversation. So the movie now runs in public libraries and for homeless advocacy groups for free, often followed by panel discussions that include law enforcement, librarians, and oftentimes to discuss, okay, this is a real issue. How are we going to solve it as a community? When you think about the cost of emergency assistance for somebody who's experiencing homelessness, in Los Angeles, it's $68,000 a year. If you put a roof over that same individual's head, it goes down to $15,000. Now, the taxpayers pay that either way. So, I don't know. I wasn't great at math, but those numbers are an evidence of what happens when you house someone first, rather than criminalizing them.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you can criminalize, you can find somebody into oblivion for jaywalking or for loitering, or you can find them into death, all the way to death. But that doesn't solve the problem. Putting a roof over their house or over their head does.
And that's should be a function of society, right? Society is meant to be built on that fundamental support of healthcare, a roof over your head, education.
That's right.
And we seem to have forgotten that.
I have risked a lot to make this film because I believed in it, because I felt that there was a place for a movie like this in this contemporary non-working system that we're currently all engaged in and a part of, whether we like it or not. And so it's been a very interesting road to hoe.
And was that risk financial?
Oh, yeah.
Or, yeah.
Oh yeah, yeah, for sure. And lost opportunity. But what I gained by making this film, I think this film is in many ways a culmination of my entire life. And I don't mean that in a trite way, but when you think about, let's talk about The Breakfast Club. It's a movie that takes place in a library. It's one location. That film informs this picture. My dad's political activism, when you think about how many, he's been arrested 69 times. And when, in all acts of civil disobedience, protesting against homelessness and nuclear proliferation and climate, immigration, but he's gone to jail now 69 times. And as a boy, I didn't really understand, I understood it fundamentally, but I didn't understand it spiritually, why he was doing what he did, because it would be televised. He'd be on TV getting carted away by the police in handcuffs, screaming the Lord's Prayer. And he looked absolutely insane. And I thought, wow, that's a bad look for my dad. I didn't get it until I started working on this film. His arrest, his political activism, his raging against the machine, a broken system, is informed. This movie's informed by that.
And also, he's spoken quite a lot about his own sobriety.
That's
and
right.
He's 30, yeah. Coming up for 30 years.
That's right, yeah.
And
yeah.
As this film is also an exploration of trauma and of
that's
addiction
right.
And how all these
that's
things
right.
intersect.
That's right.
Kind of how much did that inform it as well?
Well, I don't think that any of us walk the planet trauma-free. I think we all carry a certain amount of trauma. And I think we're at various stages of processing it or projecting it, right? We have a president in the United States now who's projecting his own personal trauma. There's an absence of love in that man's life. And in that absence of love, he projects the trauma of never knowing what it feels like to be loved. And so he'll take your hate because that's all he knows. And he's very comfortable living in that space. But it's projected trauma on the rest of us, and we're all feeling the effects of that. Christian Slater's character is not dissimilar in this character. His is an unchecked, projected trauma And you know, it's all under the guise of I'm a Law and Order candidate. It's bullshit, right? Everybody in this film, and not just this film, but in The Way, and in Bobby, right? Everybody is experiencing a certain type of trauma, and it's reflected in how they relate to each other, and again how they are processing it or not processing it. But I would say the last three films that I've devoted the last nearly 15 years of my life to are all that is the common theme, is that we are all, whether it's generational trauma, childhood trauma, or you know, perpetual trauma that people are experiencing on the daily. I like to say it's not post-traumatic stress disorder, it's perpetual stress disorder. It's reflected in the work that I've been doing.
And is that what,
for better or worse?
Well, and is that what drives you, right? Because I think people who remember you and think of you for your earlier work, whether it is The Breakfast Club or Mighty Ducks or whatever it is, they may be surprised by your choices. And you've existed in the indie film space for a decade and a half, if not more.
Really, 25 more. Years, really, since The War at Home.
Yeah.
Since I walked away from Mighty Ducks 3 and bid sort of that studio film thing a fond farewell. Thank you. It's been great. It's been a great relationship, but we're getting a divorce now, and I'm going to go into the indie film space. And it's especially now, it's a very difficult time for independent films to break out. So it's been an interesting path, and it's been a risky path, but I wouldn't change it because I think it's informed where I've arrived.
Can you
Which isn't to say that I wouldn't go back and revisit something, especially in this age of nostalgia, if an opportunity were to come up.
Anything that made sense. Particular?
No, not really. I mean, you know, I know that they're doing a Mighty Ducks series now.
They
and know is that the direction I want to go? I mean, there's only a few characters that I would even entertain revisiting. But the question is, are we at... Let's call it peak nostalgia.
Uh-huh.
Are we at a peak nostalgia? Because Tom Cruise is coming out with Top Gun.
Yes.
We've got Bill and Ted with Keanu Reeves. Martin Lawrence and Will Smith are coming out with Bad Boys 3, 4? What is it? 4?
3, 4.
Right. So Stranger Things.
Mm-hmm.
They're making a St. Elmo's Fire TV series now, or at least it's in development. So the question is, if we're at peak nostalgia...
Mm.
I don't know what else to call it, do you?
I mean, that's a pretty apt term, yeah. Right?
Or is this just the beginning? Is this just the tip of the iceberg? Because after this, where are we going to go? What are we going to reboot? Where, you know, what scab are we going to pick next? Because there are some wounds that are left best not picked at, and others that demand it.
Mm.
And do we demand going back there because... It takes us back to a safer time, to a place without social media. Does it take us back to our safe place? And that is the question. And then what if you botch it? What if you ruin the memory that an individual has over a certain work that you did? And now you can't unsee that.
Mm.
And so who is your responsibility to preserve the legacy of what you already created? Or to advance somebody's desire to want more of that? And I can't answer that question. I'm not sure anybody can, because, you know, this Terminator, I thought, man, okay, Linda Hamilton, and they're back, and I don't know, people, I guess, didn't want to go.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, listen, $29 million opening. At what place are we in our cinematic history where a $29 million opening is not good enough? Well, if you spend $200 million on the film,
well,
then yes, of course. But so then the question goes back to, why do we want it? And if we get it, are we going to be happy that we got it? Does any of that make sense?
It does. But what would be your motivation for going, whether it was a reboot or a sequel, what would be your personal motivation for doing that?
Money. Money.
A house
Loads
built
money.
Of money.
$1 billion. No, it's to tickle the fan base, to be less precious about the work that I've been doing, especially in mainstream eyes. Mm. Because I think the majority of the work that I've been doing has been unseen. I mean, Sam Rockwell said something brilliant when he got up to accept the Oscar. He's like, for three
billboards.
He's like, it's so great to be in an independent movie that people saw. the whole house went, because everybody sitting there has experienced that. Mm. Sometimes more than one or two times. So, yeah, I mean, as far as mainstream audiences, I'm still a lot of those characters that they remember. I haven't gone past them. They haven't seen where I'm at right now. And whether that's just because those films just don't get publicized in the same way, yes. Lack of interest, yes. Or this desire to keep me in that nostalgic place that is, again, the safe place for them, but not for me. So the question is, do I feel, or will I ever feel, at a place where I can say, this is something I want to revisit? Don't know. I have to ask my accountant, see where we're at.
Because
his nickname is Doom and Gloom, so it doesn't matter what I ask him. He says, oh God, it's all bad, Amelia. It's all bad. I drive a 12-year-old car that's got 260,000 miles on it. I have a very, very small imprint. I don't have I don't have, you know, expensive ex-wives, and I don't have a lifestyle. You see what I'm wearing? It's like very simple clothing.
It's lovely.
And thank you. And so I don't have this extravagant lifestyle that demands that I make a lot of money, and so I haven't in a long time.
There would be a thrill, though, I'm presuming, you know, whether it was you did another Young Guns or you did another Mighty Ducks or something, gasp, untouchable, like The Breakfast Club or St. Elmo's Fire.
Right.
There must be kind of a thrill with that in terms of the chance to reconnect with those people who hold those things so dearly.
Right. But don't you reckon that belongs to them and not me, right? That belongs to that sort of collective experience, which is not, I mean, I did the work, right? So that experience, the actual process, that's what I love the most. I've never been comfortable with the show part of show business. I love the business. I love the process. I love making the film. I love making the widget. But once the widget leaves the factory, I'm like, bye, widget. So long, widget. No, you know, it's very difficult for me to be connected to that outcome when I'm just merely an actor in something. When I'm, and oftentimes you'll hear people say, well, they'll be connected to the outcome. But if you're a director and a writer and you've spent 12 years making, so if I'm not connected to the outcome, then I'm insane for having done it, right? Of course I want people to see the public. And it's outside of my control whether they do or not, but doing this interview, making myself available to get out there and promote the film, that is within my control. And I choose to do that because, again, I am connected to the outcome of that. I had no idea, we talked about this earlier, that The Way would inspire all of those people. So that outcome was something that I couldn't have even imagined. I think, did I mention that the New York Times wrote a piece about the economy in northern Spain being directly affected by the film in terms of tourism? So it's like, okay, I couldn't have predicted that outcome. I wasn't attached to it. But here, I would like for this picture to continue a conversation towards a more empathetic and more compassionate way of life, because I think that we're in a very dark place around the globe. It's not limited to the UK and the United States. The world is in chaos, and I think it's reflected in how we treat each other. I think the chaos is reflected in how our inability to talk to one another, and the art of communication is gone. But we all have really strong thumbs from texting, right? Well, we've lost this. We've lost this. It's not confrontational, but it's getting in the room and being able to look at somebody you may not agree with, and coming away from that meeting with more in common than you have not.
Well, Emilio Estevez, thank you so much. I'm off home to look at that picture of you in the Millwall shirt.
Good Lord. No. It's only going to get me beat up in a pub here.
Possibly. Yeah. You may have to go out in a disguise.
I may just. I'll go out in an Aston Villa jersey. What about that? Or a Barcelona jersey.
Barcelona may be safest.
There you go. Yeah. All right. Thank you.
All right, so that was Emilio Estevez talking to Terry White, and we will be discussing The Public in due course. Oh, hey, while we're plugging things, completely forgot to mention that we're going to be in Dublin on March 6th. We're doing a live show. I haven't really mentioned that much because we've sold out. Hooray! But if you want to come along...
You're basically taunting people now.
There will always be returns, Helen. I'm sure tickets may become available via the Dublin International Film Festival if you wish to check them out. But myself, Helen, and I think James, you're coming to that as well, are you?
I will be there.
Okay, so sorry about that, people of Ireland.
Should we bring some Northern Irish Tatoes with me?
Oh, God, it's all going to kick off.
The battle lines are drawn.
It's all going to kick off.
Obviously, Northern Irish Tatoes are better, but, you know.
Well, yes. As in so much.
But Southern Cadbury's. Oh, what? Southern Cadbury's?
What are you talking about? Now, what's the difference?
It tastes better. And they have different flavors.
Okay, that's... No, flavoured Cadbury's straight off the bat is...
Yeah, leprechauns mix the chocolate a little bit more differently down there, don't they? And they're jumping up and down.
Self-hating racism there, Chris.
Wow.
Absolutely spot on.
It's going to be great. Are we going to go on a city tour during the day, or are we going to do...
Of course we're fucking not. You know how we do these things. We fly into the city. There's some kind of panic.
We don't manage to do anything.
Throw ourselves face first into a mound of cocaine the size of a small island. Of course we do.
Wait, where was I?
We hit the city's hottest night spots.
Do we?
It's jazziest clubs.
Yes, I remember that from when we went to Belfast, where we did the gig. We went back, we went to some dodgy takeaway pizza place, got some pizzas, took them back to the hotel bar, and then tried to eat them subtly under the table so no one would see us eating them in the bar and throw us out.
Yep.
Wow.
Well, I say cocaine, but what I really mean is, yes, £6
pizza. Mounds of cocaine, I mean mounds of pizza.
How do you want your pizza? Can I have some cocaine on it, please? Rock and roll. Hashtag rock and roll. No, we're really boring. But we'll probably arrive first thing that day. We may get a chance to walk around Dublin.
We could go to the
Dublin.
Book of Kells. We could see the Long Library in Trinity College Dublin. It'd be amazing. I can take you up and down O'Connell Street and explain who all the statues are and what they did to
you. It's just
going
to be like when you promised to show me giants when we went to Belfast and that didn't happen.
I wanted to. You wouldn't give me enough time to take you to the causeway.
When we went to York, you wouldn't let me go around the chocolate factory.
That's true.
Yeah.
So,
or even the walls. Or the Minster.
We did end up in Diagon Alley.
Yeah, we didn't go into the big church either. We're terrible at this.
That's because I would have burst into flames.
I keep trying to tell you guys.
All right. Anyway, so we're going to be in Dublin. It's going to be a whole thing. We'll talk about the details as and when.
It'll be great crack.
It's going to be fantastic.
The crack will be 90.
The crack will be mighty.
Yeah, and we're not just talking about the pre-show, you know, indulgences.
Anyway, enough of that nonsense. Now it's time to talk about the movies that are out to watch this week. Two big ones. Sonic the Hedgehog. Amon, you have seen this movie.
I have.
I have not seen this movie.
That's a shame.
Is it?
No. Sonic the Hedgehog. Sonic is in prison. No, I'm joking.
Calling back to previous podcasts.
Sonic, it actually begins with a prologue that sees Sonic be forced out of his home world onto Earth. So he's been living on Earth for a few years when we sort of meet up with him. He's, you know, living his best life, maxing and relaxing. But then he causes an energy surge with his powers, and that attracts Dr. Robotnik, who's played by Jim Carrey. And then he wants to harness Sonic's powers. So Sonic has to befriend the local cop, Tom, played by James Marsden of Cyclops fame.
Oh, I love him.
And they have to sort of team up to stop Dr. Robotnik. So here's the thing which I really, really like about this movie. The hero and the villain are actually really well cast and they played really, really well. Ben Schwartz, he voices Sonic, and he's got just the right amount of childlike energy to really bring him to life. Because it's very easy for that character to come across as irritating instead of endearing, and they get that right. Jim Carrey is utterly fantastic in this movie. I loved watching him. He's in the mask type form. He's that type of wacky dude in this, and he's just so entertaining to watch. Every second he's on screen, he's doing something interesting. So that's really, really great. Unfortunately, the movie that they're in is not very, very good. The first thing to say is that the main sort of thrust of this is centers on the bromance between Sonic and the cop, James Marsden. And it's very, very bland. It feels like it's missing a few key beats. So when the more emotional stuff sort of happens in the final third of the movie, it doesn't really hit as hard as you'd like. The action wow. sequences, mm-hmm. they're very derivative of Quicksilver's big moment in X-Men Days of Future Past. And that's not to say that they don't have their charms, but it just feels derivative, which is a shame. I will say this, the effects, obviously, you know, the first trailer came out April 2019 and it was met with a backlash, shall we say. I still can't believe, you know, the amount of people who had to okay that was insane. Yeah. Like, Gangster's Paradise soundtracked that trailer. That's insane to me.
It should soundtrack every trailer.
it's a banger, but, you know, maybe not appropriate for Sonic. Mm. But the new Sonic's new look is very, very good. There are still times when the CGI is noticeably bad, but for the most part, it's good. The final thing I'll say is this. Mm-hmm. We need to have a conversation about banning flossing from any and all movies.
No, do you mean the teeth care or do you mean the dance?
I mean the dance. Mm. It's time, Helen.
It's had its moment, you think?
I mean, it's going to date this movie really, really badly, but just on a more important note, I don't want to see it. It's just, it's not good. It's the fastest way to elicit an eye roll from me today watching a movie is to start flossing. Just don't do it.
I will say watching Ted Danson learn to floss on the set of The Good Place was one of the great joys of last year.
So. I will allow that. So it's frustrating because I think there are some components here to make an actual really, really good video game movie, but it doesn't quite come together. They do tease a lot of sequels or they have a lot of teasers for future films at the end of this movie. And you know, the kids may well make this a hit, so we may well get those sequels. If we do, I hope the storytelling picks up.
Interesting. Do you think it will come to that? I don't think it will. Do you?
It could be a hit. I could see this being a hit.
Do you think it will?
But yeah, and again, and I'm not too mad at it because I would not mind seeing Jim Carrey play this character again. He is fantastic as Dr. Robotnik. I cannot stress that enough. He is amazing. Mm-hmm. But yeah, the story around it is just very bland and formulaic and forgettable, unfortunately.
Oh, that's not good. You don't want your Sonic the Hedgehog movie to be bland and formulaic and forgettable.
Yeah.
Like all the games, I guess.
Hey, well. I like the games. It's really cool. This one of the first things we hear in this movie is Sega, which brought back a whole bunch of nostalgia for me.
I'm just terrible at the games. I'm legitimately terrible at anything that's not FIFA. And then even when I played online at FIFA recently, I discovered that I'm not as good as I think I am. Because you play a bunch of 12-year-olds.
It's the perfect time to renew my challenge to you.
And they're just like, well, oh, Xbox died.
Oh, this is perfect. I mean, you know, come to the dark side. Come to my side. PS4 or PS5, as it's soon going to be.
Oh, okay. Or alternatively, yeah, if anyone wants to send me an Xbox. Yeah. Yeah. No, can't do that. Can't do that. No, bad, Chris, bad. Yes. So that's Sonic the Hedgehog, and we gave that
2 stars.
2 stars. 2 stars there for Sonic the Hedgehog. Next up is Emma, which I believe is a remake of Clueless, as the aforementioned
yes.
Clueless
it is,
we were
yes.
talking about. And this one stars Anya Taylor-Joy, and this is from the first-time director Autumn de Wilde,
yeah.
which is an incredible name.
Fantastic name. Yeah, superb work. This is a slightly more, you know, faithful to Jane Austen take on Emma, who? Set in Regency England. And Anya Taylor-Joy is handsome, clever and rich, and she's trying to matchmake all around her after having some success setting up her governess. She, meanwhile, completely fails to notice that her, like, BFF, Mr. Knightley, played by Johnny Flynn, is, like, meant to be, or whatever. They are, like, MFEO, to quote another 90s
Is he a Baldwin?
He's a total Baldwin. In the 90s sense, not the modern sense. You've got Josh O'Connor as Mr. Elton. You've got Callum Turner, very, very good, actually, as Mr. Churchill. And it's, or Frank Churchill. It's, I really enjoyed this, but I have to say, our official review disagrees with me. So Ian Freer wrote the review, and he basically found it a bit tonally inconsistent, because it does go to some very pastel, bright kind of Marie Antoinette places in sort of portraying Emma's lifestyle. And he found that a little bit jarring with some of the other stuff in the story, and that it hopped around too much between very, very comic scenes and then the slightly more emotional stuff. I don't know. For me, it just worked a bit better than that. So I find myself, for once, and unusually, at odds with Ian on this. But yeah, we gave it 2 stars.
2 stars.
I have a question in regards to that then, because obviously Greta Gerwig's Little Women flipped around with the timelines a lot, but it made sort of more tonal sense. Do you think Emma should have done something similar?
I don't think there's any room for playing around with timelines in Emma, to be honest, but there might be room for some kind of slightly more loose adaptation. But then, you know, this one very deliberately used a lot of the dialogue from the book and took that. But also, it does have a bit of a modern feel to it. It does have it's not stuffy, I didn't think. You know, it does kind of loosen things up. I mean, it has some nudity.
What?
Male as well as female.
No.
From the rear.
From the bottom.
Mm-hmm. There's quite a lot of bottoms. Well, there's 2 bottoms in it. I'm just saying, so you see some bottoms.
Do they rub together?
No, they're in... Well, I mean, ultimately, I think we can say yes, but not in the scenes where we see them. So, yeah.
Is that how sex works?
I mean, honestly, who remembers?
Wow. Okay.
Anyway,
there we go.
2 stars.
Happy Valentine's Day, Helen.
Oh, God.
2 stars then for Emma. 2 stars, of course, for Sonic the Hedgehog as well. But hey, don't fret. Just because there's nothing decent out this week in the cinemas, although obviously Helen and Amon both think that Emma is perhaps better than 2 stars, so maybe give that a shout if you fancy it. Parasite is expanding, as parasites are wont to do. For example, in our local cinema, it's on 2 screens over the weekend, which is the sort of thing that you usually see reserved for a Star Wars or an MCU movie. So it's good to see that happening as well. And there's tons of other great films as well.
Yep, Queen and Slim, Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood.
Yep.
Really good.
Little Women is still available. Jojo Rabbit is still available. Knives Out is still available. Still screening this weekend in my local cinema. You know what? I suspect foul play.
No, Chris. No, as your lawyer, I should make clear that you don't suspect foul play. It's just because it's popular.
I suspect popular play. Anyway, on that note, that is it for this week's Empire Podcast. Join us next week for more film-related fun. We'll be joined by...
Who?
I can never remember. I think Justin Kurtzel, the director of True History of the Kelly Gang, and Elizabeth Moss, star of The Invisible Man.
Wow.
Now you see her. Well, you see her because she's not invisible. Mm. The man's invisible.
Do we know who's starring as him?
Yes.
Oh.
Surely it's John Cena.
How can you tell?
Thank you, Amon.
Because he's seen her?
Because you can't see him.
Oh, I see. It's a wrestling joke. I see.
Oh, my God.
I'm here for you, James.
Thank you. Thank you.
That may be the last Empire Podcast. What a way to finish. He said fuck all for the last 20 minutes. He chips in with that. Unbelievable. Anyway, until next week, until that auspicious occasion, until we meet again, it is goodbye from James Dyer.
Bye, Chris.
Bye, James. it is goodbye from Amon Warman.
Peace.
That was half-hearted at best, wasn't it?
I was trying to compose myself. I was still laughing.
Wasn't that funny?
See, now I'm appreciating.
Now you found your
finally
level.
Finally.
You found your level. Unbelievable. It's goodbye from Helen O'Hara.
Toodaloo.
And it's goodbye from me. I'm off to get my Xbox fixed. Then, Amon, I'm coming for you. FIFA, it's on.
Let's do it.
I'm scared now. Thanks for listening. See you next time. Bye-bye.